Progressive Radio News Hour with Stephen Ledman, Thursdays at 11 a.m. and weekends at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
To the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Dave Lindoff. Dave is an award-winning investigative reporter, journalist. He's contributed to many, many publications, popular websites. He's done it for many years here in America, abroad. He's also a prolific author. I've read several of his books. I absolutely endorse anything Dave writes. I think the first one I read was his book on marketplace medicine. He concentrated on the big hospital chains, but indeed we are plagued with marketplace medicines. Medicine, it doesn't go down easily, especially for people who, that's another topic altogether. But a couple of other books that Dave wrote. He wrote The Case for Impeachment, Legal Arguments for Removing George W. Bush. I think he could simply republish the book and change the name Bush to the name Obama, and the same arguments more or less would apply. Again, another topic. Maybe we can talk about it a little bit. And another book that I remember so well that I read, This Can't Be Happening, Resisting the Disintegration of American Democracy. Oh, they just keep chipping away at it a little bit at a time. There really isn't a heck of a lot of it left. Anyway, lots of topics, lots of things going on. The world is really in a boil, both domestically and abroad. Dave, I know you're in motion at the moment. I welcome you to the program.
Hi, Steve. Well, my son's driving, so I'm cool.
Oh, wonderful. I've done this twice. I interviewed one guest. He was on his own driving, I guess, one hand on the steering wheel, the other on his cell phone. And I had one guest sometime back who was on a bus in New York heading for a protest on Wall Street during the height of the financial crisis. And you could hear all the rumbling and noise in the background. But in that case, I thought the side effects were wonderful, considering the topic we were discussing, which was exactly what he was going out to join the protest on.
Yeah, right. Okay. Well, I don't know. I hope the car's not too noisy. It's a cheap Honda.
No, I don't hear a thing.
Excellent.
I think we'll do just fine. Oh, my goodness, so much going on, Dave. I want to go overseas first. We have the unending wars. This country simply can't get enough wars. They start one, they either end it and go to another, or they fight multiple ones at the same time. And by my count, Obama is fighting five wars directly, plus proxy ones. And the ones I count are Iraq. We had the bogus pullout a year ago, August. We have Afghanistan. We had, in my email to you, I called it a head fake withdrawal. Still 50,000 odd troops left in Iraq. And when Obama took office, there were 34,000 in Afghanistan. 34,000 too much, as a matter of fact. But he tripled the number, and now by the end of 2012, he's going to knock off 10,000. So it's like a loan shark tripling the price of your interest. And then he says, I'm going to give you a break. I'll cut a little sliver off it and make it easier, but not right away. It'll only be incremental over the next year and a half. And over that time, Dave, we know anything can happen. They can change their mind again. They can find all kinds of reasons. And the others are in Pakistan. Obama escalated it tremendously. And Libya, of course. And we're also bombing Yemen. I don't follow the mainstream news that carefully, except to monitor where they're going in case I want to do a critique, Dave. But my guess is they're not talking at all about Yemen, and they may even be talking less about Libya. Am I wrong?
No, that's absolutely right. You're right about the five wars. And you're right about the escalation. It's not. It hasn't gone down. It's gone up. And you in the introduction you mentioned my book about the case for impeachment, and you know with one of the key parts of that argument was illegal wars, and on both counts, illegal under the U.S. Constitution because they weren't authorized by Congress, and illegal in terms of the U.N. Charter, which is the current version of the Nuremberg Charter, drawn up after World War II, under which an aggressive invasion against a country that poses no immediate threat is the ultimate war crime. And on all these counts, Obama is more guilty than Bush.
He sure is. There's no question about it. And, of course, the debate over Libya. I wrote one article. Gee, I write so many, Dave, I forget the titles, but I think the title of this one was something like Duplicitous Congressional Posturing Over Libya War. The debate is so disingenuous. I mean, these people are just liars. So the Republicans, on the one hand, are berating Obama for not coming to Congress for authorization. But aside from the way a president and a Congress will get together by some manner or means, never officially, Congress has not declared war, and of course only Congress by the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, only the Congress can declare war, never, never the president. And the War Powers Resolution they talk about, that's only in case America is attacked by another country or another power, whatever, and then the president, his commander-in-chief, can take action against that for 60 days with a 30-day window. Supposedly the window is to withdraw forces before he needs official congressional authorization. But everything goes back to the UN Charter. America is a member of the UN, and every treaty, and the Charter is effectively a treaty, every treaty that America is a signatory to is automatically U.S. law under the Constitution Supremacy Clause. So the UN Charter.
That, by the way, is one I love, you know, because these idiots on the right that say, oh, America's surrendering its power to, you know, the black helicopter global forces of world government. And, you know, it's the Constitution that these people revere, supposedly, was written to say that, you know, the Congress and the U.S. government could enter into treaties with other countries, and that those treaties, of course, have the force of law. They're approved and by the Senate. It goes through a ratification process, and once you do that, it has the force of law under that document we supposedly revere. So to say that, you know, the United States is surrendering its power to global government and all this nonsense is such incredible ignorance and duplicity right there. When we sign a treaty, that's the law. And part of that law is that war is illegal since World War II if you invade a country that doesn't pose an immediate threat to you.
Well, there's no question about that, Dave. And the last time we obeyed the law, at least as far as the Constitution went, was on December 8th, 1941. And I think listeners can imagine what happened on that date, the day after the big day. ever since then, America has gone to war illegally based on what the Constitution itself says, never mind treaties that we signed on to, and, of course, the bedrock UN Charter that sounds so lovely, except we ignore it, and the other belligerent powers in the world ignore it as well, and the UN powers, well, the Secretary General is merely a tool of the world powers, mainly America. Nobody gets appointed Secretary General unless America says okay or handpicks them. So you've got this Ban Ki-moon character, and to think of him as a legitimate head of a world body, it's about as legitimate as Bush and Obama being the head of America and governing like a Democrat, Dave. I mean, those ideas are so nonsensical. They simply don't happen. So every war, America is waging.
Yeah, I think the UN Security Secretary Generals have known that they have to do America's bidding ever since the CIA offed Dag Hammarskjöld. It was probably the first and only UN Secretary General to displease the United States.
You know, that was so long ago. I do remember him, but
he went down in a plane over Africa, which is widely believed to have been an execution.
He did meet an untimely end. That I seem to recall, and it's very easy.
I believe he was Finnish.
Was it Finnish or Swedish?
I think it was Finnish.
Was it Finnish?
Yeah.
He might have been the best of the lot of the UN Secretary Generals. And
those kind of lessons are learned by successors, you know.
Just the way presidents after Kennedy learned the Kennedy lesson very well.
Exactly. I think Obama's following that lesson right now.
Oh, there's no question. I live in Chicago, Dave, and Obama claimed Chicago was his home, and I wrote about and I still remember November 22nd, 2008, when the word came down about 10 o'clock in the evening that he was the official winner. And in Grant Park, Chicago, a big area in downtown Chicago, a couple of miles from where I live, I was nowhere near it. But that afternoon, businesses let their people out early. It's just astonishing what happened that day. Businesses closed down early, like Christmas Eve, when companies close down at midday, so people can go home and prepare for Christmas Eve. And that's what companies did on that day. And there was a mass assemblage in Grand Park. And they put up a big TV screen that I read about. I didn't see it. And then they had CNN on. And about 10 o'clock at night, they announced officially that Obama was the winner. And the city went wild. The city went wild. And I wrote about the people who saw it firsthand. So I recounted what they said about it. And it was like contagious madness. I mean, did these people really think they were going to get a guy in office who was going to take care of their interest and sweep away all of the wrongs of the Bush years and open up a new era? And a lot of intelligent people believed that, you know, not perfectly, but still believed that this guy really would be different. What everybody needs to understand is none of them are different. It simply doesn't matter whether it's Obama or Bush or whoever comes next. And whether it's 2012 or 2016, there'll be another new president. I suspect it'll be even worse. He or she will be even worse than Obama.
Yeah, it seems to be a downhill slide. The corporatocracy has become much more brazen and blatant in terms of how it is running the show. There aren't even fewer and fewer pretenses or sops to the public. They're basically feeling like they've got us, you know, by the short hairs, and they don't have to pretend anymore. So it's really quite amazing to see.
It really is amazing, David. We had the episode in the House on Friday. Again, more duplicity, more hypocrisy. The House voted not to authorize the Libyan war, but they also voted not to cut off funding for it. Well, the message that says to me was, forget about what the resolution says. What it means is that they have endorsed this war going on, and they'll do nothing to cut off funding, and the House has power to do that. The appropriations initiate in the House. They could end every U.S. war in one morning, in one afternoon, simple up or down votes. And they literally could bring all of the imperial wars to an end, and the money would run out, and the troops would have to come home. I don't think the Congress would leave them stranded someplace. There'd be enough money to bring them home, but they literally could shut these wars down, and that's exactly how the Vietnam War ended.
I was just going to say, that's the last time that actually happened, was that Congress demonstrated that they could do that. It's an interesting question. I wonder if, first of all, your point about duplicity is absolutely right, that Congress has this power and is afraid to use it. But I'm curious, I wonder if today, if Congress did do that, if the House did vote to cut off the funding and said that money could only be used for withdrawing troops from Afghanistan, whether we've reached such a collapse of congressional power and such a stage of usurpation of government power by the executive that we would see a president, this president or the next one, actually ignore that and juggle the money from other, the Pentagon has an enormous amount of money, and I wonder whether we would see them juggle the money in the Pentagon budget and just keep the wars going by pulling it out of other things from the $1 trillion that the Pentagon gets every year.
Well, that's a very good point. Of course, the Congress could pass a resolution with very specific language. I mean, I just can't imagine the Congress doing this. But
no, that's it. I wonder whether they'd get stiffed.
Well, they could avoid getting stiff by putting specific language in that no funding may be used from any other budget. You got this defense appropriation budget. The Pentagon, the CIA, the other intelligence agencies, who knows whatever, they have black budgets with unknown tens of billions of dollars stashed in them.
So there's a
lot of money sloshing around. And, of course, you got the Federal Reserve, which is not a government operation. It's a banker operation. But I'm sure they can work out a deal with the Fed to print up some ready cash to keep these wars going. But again, the Congress could write a very specific bill with all of these points addressed and saying it is illegal to use 10 cents of U.S. money from any budget for war making. I mean, they could be very specific, but, that's like expecting the tooth fairy to show up.
Yeah, but even then, when you think about it, that would cause a constitutional crisis if the president wanted to, under the current day, to challenge it, because it would end up in the Supreme Court, and we know who's in the Supreme Court, and the philosophy in the Supreme Court now is that the executive has this unitary power during wartime. So I could imagine the Scalia majority just saying, well, we're at war, the president can take money from somewhere else when he needs to. I really think we've sunk to this incredible level where we basically have accepted the idea that, I say we have accepted that people just don't pay attention to politics where it really counts. And so we have, concerns about abortion, or budget deficits and stuff. But the big issue is that under Bush and now under Obama, the executive has just usurped this incredible amount of power backed by this Supreme Court majority that says that executives in wartime can do whatever they damn please. And we have not nobody has challenged the notion that the war on terror is a war.
Well, again, so true, Dave. And again, I think neither one of us can imagine the Congress literally doing the right thing, even for the wrong reason. The wrong reason would be doing it for political advantage, as opposed to saying this is the law and it's high time that this country obeyed it. They would never do it for that reason. But for the Republicans to knock off the Democrats, they might be willing to sell off their mother to be able to do that. The Democrats aren't quite as aggressive, but that's why I say all the time that the bottom line for me is forget the people holding government positions, whether appointed or allegedly elected. Forget about them, because they'll do nothing to protect the rights of ordinary people here, abroad, anywhere. It's up to the people of this country to decide they're not going to take it anymore. And when people decide that, they have a lot of power. I have a new article I'm working on Greece. I wrote another one on Greece in an IMF article. And I'm writing again about Greece because it looks like they're going to ram through this austerity package, which really is as bad as things are in Greece now. They ram that thing through. I mean they're going to turn Greece into, oh, my goodness, I mean, some deeply impoverished country. They're taking the birthplace of democracy, and they're turning it into a third world backwater, and it's heading there at flank speed. And my solution to that is for en masse the working people of Greece to decide. They can't fight the politicians. Don't even try. Don't forget about going out in the street and protesting. It's a waste of time. But there's one thing they can do, and it can work, and there's nobody can stop them, and nobody can stop the damage from it, even though it hurts them. But better to take a lot of pain now than take less over a shorter time that amounts to as much or more, actually more. And the tool that they have is general strike. Shut down the entire country.
Well, they do that in Greece.
Oh, we could do it here, Dave. We could do it here. But again, you can't rely on the unions. The unions side with the other side. They do it in Europe. They do it in this country. The union bosses are corrupted. Why the rank and file put up with this, I have no idea. But, they get these people in power and they sell out to the corporate bosses and the government officials. But workers on their own, if they would simply in some way organize en masse across industry lines, and in a country like Greece, it's a small country. I think it's about 11 million people or so. It's small. They could literally shut that country down and keep it shut down until all of this austerity stuff is swept away. That would be step one for me. Step two for me, the entire sitting government goes, call an election. They have a parliamentary system. They can call a new election anytime, unlike here. Well, I guess we can impeach people and have an election or something or other. But we have a congressional system. They have a parliamentary system. They literally, you can have a parliamentary crisis, call a new election, sweep the bastards out, and put new people in. But the thing that absolutely can work, if enough people would do it, is a general strike. It almost happened and worked in France in 1968. It lasted a month, but the energy waned and the bad guys won.
Yeah. You know what? I heard a really interesting discussion that kind of blew my mind. I was a YouTube discussion on, I think, Morningstar, if I'm right, not mistaken. But there were three financial analysts talking. One of them was a Brit, and he made the point that if the large European countries, Germany in particular, wanted to stop the Greek financial crisis, they could do it actually more cheaply than by granting debt extensions and things like they're doing, by simply giving Greece money. Like if they gave them money to finance their interest payments going forward and didn't do it in the form of more debt, which is what the IMF does and what the EU is doing to its to these peripheral countries like Ireland and Greece and Portugal. And I think, interestingly, you could probably expand this to talk about, you know, the U.S. and our finagling with the finances of, you know, leftist-leaning countries in Latin America. He made the point that it would be cheaper and more successful and better for all concerned, including especially the people of those countries, to just give them the money they need to cover their debt payments.
Oh, I think that is absolutely on the mark, Dave.
It's an astonishing recognition by a banker, you know, that this is the answer. But we're not going to see it done because actually they want these countries to be in peonage.
They sure do, and the idea
as we want the countries in Latin America to be in peonage. You know, this is Greece and the Eastern Bloc countries are the industrial countries of Europe's South America.
The way to fix an economy is put people back to work, give them a living wage and the decent benefits that they deserved. They will have money. They will go out and spend it. Consumers are roughly 70% of the economy. That will make an economy prosper. But the scheme is to do just the opposite of that. And what's going on in Greece is a model for what's going on elsewhere. It's been going on here for a while at a slower pace. It's going on more across Europe. And the idea is to put them in economic crisis. And you get the IMF structural adjustment prescription, which is privatize state industries, sell them off on the cheap, sell other state assets on the cheap, lay people off, the working people, cut their wages, cut their benefits, literally starve the country and reduce the value of the businesses and the other assets owned by the state, sell them off at fire sale prices. So this is the way that the vulture capitalists can raid a country and buy stuff that they really would like to get their hands on, like the public utilities. And Greece has a lottery, their ports, their airports, other public facilities that they can buy on the cheap, and then begin raising prices incrementally over time, make a killing on these deals. Well, if you covet these assets, you don't want to pay full price for them. So you tank the economy and get them at half price, quarter price, 10 cents on the dollar, whatever it comes down to. And in the case of Greece, and I said this in my other article talking about Greece, it was one section of an IMF article, and then what I'm working on today, which is really entirely about Greece, is they want Greece to sell off its crown jewels, and that's the deal, to get a bailout, a loan, and they already got something like $110 billion last year. It was putting a Band-Aid on an open wound. It wasn't enough. They need more. This one won't work either. They'll need more in an endless sucking the country dry and impoverishing the people. And then you move, and they're doing it in Portugal, and they're doing it in Ireland, and then it's on to Spain, and then it's on to Italy. It's coming here. It's going to spread across Europe, probably hit the UK. I mean, it's a vicious, dirty game, and it's all planned. This is no accident. It's all planned, and it's the opposite of fixing the economy. So in this country, Dave, and I saw these numbers. Oh, I put some of them in an article that I wrote, that the so-called recovery from our economic debacle end of 2007, 2008, 2009. The economy didn't improve so much. It was minuscule, and we have a Main Street depression, but corporate profits soared because they shed hundreds of thousands of employees. They simply cut their expenses so greatly, and all the benefits of the so-called recovery, something like 90%+ of the benefits went to corporations that fattened their bottom line, and that's the reason the stock market doubled. Well, that game may be running out now, and you get this quantitative easing, which is the Fed printing money, monetizing the U.S. debt, and again, it's going to the bankers. They're not putting the money into the economy, so the bankers are prospering, the war profiteers are prospering, and basically corporate America is prospering at the expense of people. There has never been a U.S. recession, depression, call it what you will, that has been handled the way this one has been by a sitting government.
What we have going on here, Steve, is actually the U.S. is doing, the government and the financiers in the U.S. are doing to the U.S. exactly what the IMF does to third world countries, only we're not waiting for the IMF to do it. We're doing it to ourselves. We're actually using the crisis deliberately to create a new paradigm in the U.S. of low wages, and and a you know, basically it'll end up being an export economy because they're going to drive their wages down so far. But this is really consciously being done. The recession is being used as an opportunity. I'm not sure they engineered the recession. I don't think that happened. But I think what happened is that when the recession happened, all these powerful corporate forces looked at the situation as an opportunity. And to them, you know, the thing people have to realize is that a business doesn't need to have high growth in order to profit. What they're doing is they're shifting the level of economic activity in the U.S. to a new lower level where you'll have a standard of much higher unemployment, much lower income levels, much lower middle class. They're going to redefine full employment probably as 8% at some point, and say, well, we're out of the recession, now we have full employment. You know, in my lifetime, I've watched the definition of full employment rise from as far back as I have an economic memory, when it was 3%. And now when the recession started, it was 5% or 5.5%, and I think we'll end up calling 8% full employment. These aren't the real numbers, of course. You always have to double them. But so it'd be 16% when you count the ones that are now left off of the figures, which would be those people still who give up searching for jobs, those people working fewer hours than they want to work, that kind of thing. But at any rate, the point is that they will reset the economy at a much lower level of economic output, of national income, and so on. And then, you know, meanwhile, the profits for the companies will be soaring because for them it's, you know, sales minus expenses gives profits. And so it doesn't matter whether the sales are lower as long as the costs are even lower.
And also the top 10% of the working population, Dave, the better that the cream of the U.S. population with the most income, they do by far the majority of the buying. So they can make up a large extent of what the bottom 90% cannot do. Anyway, we'll take a break and we'll be right back.
This is the number one radio station for progressive independent thinkers, the Progressive Radio Network.
Your favorite show on Progressive Radio Network? Go to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com anytime, day or night, for all of our great shows. Don't be left out and miss important shows and information. Visit ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and be in the loop.
Hey, Lee.
Yeah, Jeff.
Your girlfriend gave another interview.
No, don't play it.
Listen to this.
I have a journalism degree. That is what I studied. I understand that this cornerstone of our democracy is a free press.
Shut it off. I said not to play it.
We are in the worst reality show in history.
Why won't she shut up?
You know she's going to be president, right?
Okay, stop it. That's not funny.
I think we should just go limp. Lay back. Maybe then the Mama Grizzly won't tear off your limbs.
Cheater in the Rude, Thursdays, 8 p.m., Progressive Radio Network.
Hello, I'm Carol Brie, host of Community Currency, connecting people, ideas, important information, nurturing human renaissance, seeking to transform disintegrating empire into healthy, problem-solving, creative, evolutionary, peaceful communities. To hear us, listen every Thursdays, 5 to 6 p.m. on Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Allison Rose Levy. I've been a health journalist for 25 years. I'm currently blogging on the Huffington Post. After more than two decades of studying, talking about, exchanging, and reporting on integrative well-being and collective psychology, I think we're ready to step up to the next level. On Connect the Dots, we're going to reach beyond the merely individual look at health to look at the community, societal, and global level of what we need to address to better our health. Please join me Saturdays at noon Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network, and I look forward to dialoguing with you.
You have been listening to a progressive moment on the Progressive Radio Network.
Talking to Dave Lindoff. Dave, a longtime investigative journalist, reporter, his writing on so many issues, so important, so thorough. Anyone can follow Dave. Dave, give listeners your website so they can follow you from that. They can spot you on many, many websites. They'll post your articles. But tell them what your website is again so they can go right there.
A online newspaper, independent online newspaper called This Can't Be Happening. It's at thiscan'tbehappening.net, all written out in one word, thiscan'tbehappening.net. It's a collective of four journalists, myself, John Grant, Lynn Washington, and Charles Young. And I'm happy to report that this month we're beginning our second year of daily publication, which blows my mind.
Oh, well,
I'm not going to say that we have a great business model, but our business model was that everyone who reads it would give us $5 a year. And it hasn't been working that well, but we're getting a lot of readers. We had our 2 millionth hit a couple weeks ago. And, you know, I just wish everybody that read it would realize the importance of giving us $5.
To keep a website going, it does take some expense. I just keep a blog, and I keep it. I actually began it for myself only. It was suggested to me, and I thought it was a good idea just to store everything that I write in chronological order, and I'm sure I use it more than anybody because I go back and I refer to old stuff all the time.
Sure.
Material that I researched that I want to draw from. And I also cite older articles in current ones that I'm working with a link that readers can go to them. And there it is. And I honestly don't keep track of how many people use the blog. Occasionally somebody will email me and tell me they follow it regularly. I'm delighted to hear that. And the simplest way to find my blog is just Google my name. I simply Google Lindman. And there aren't many Lindmans around, and I may be the only one who writes. So when I Google Lindman, my blog comes right up on top, and all my articles are there, from the newest going back to the first one I wrote in the summer of 2005. I'm a late bloomer. I was not a writer. I did not do what you did, Dave. I had another working life, and I stumbled onto this one accidentally, let alone stumbling on hosting a radio program and getting people to want me to come on their program. And this was all what I call a glorious accident. I never planned it. I never dreamed it. And even to this day, it's hard for me to imagine that it's happening. But I hope good health willing, I'll stay at this for many years to come, and if that's the case, I can't imagine doing anything more than this, and I can do it as a second career. I'm not concerned about earning a living and supporting a growing family. I don't have that on my mind, so I can simply concentrate on what I want to do, and that's the way I spend my time, and I love it. Can I mention one thing? On Thursday, I had on Paul Craig Roberts, and he ticked off a number of the serious economic problems that he sees the country going through. And the one that topped his list, and he's written about this at least several times, is the fact that over many years, especially since the 1980s, we have offshored our best-paying jobs. We've offshored the nation's industrial base and many high-paying professional jobs, especially technical ones. Anything that can be done overseas a lot cheaper. Companies shift the jobs abroad, China, to India, to wherever, and these jobs are gone here. So what's being
left? Well, he's written about something else which gets zero press here, and that is that in addition to shipping the high-paying jobs overseas, what the U.S. has been doing is with these H-1B visas, this is just a gigantic scam that companies are bringing in highly trained, you know, PhD engineers and technical, you know, scientific technical people from places like China, India, Indonesia, Vietnam, and so on, and giving them the job. They lay off the people that America trains at its universities and put in people who will work for a hell of a lot less from these other countries. I actually have friends from China, and I spend a lot of time in China, and you know, so I empathize with their need to get out. But nonetheless, these friends of mine who happen to have had the right degrees, you know, physics and engineering, are working now in the U.S. They've gotten their green cards and in some cases their citizenship, but they're not people who were involved in any kind of political activity that led them to get asylum, which I absolutely support. But they've come over here for economic gain. They get better pay here than they get there, and the corporations that hire them, U.S. corporations, are scaling the system with the full complicity of ICE and the Congress, and they're taking away American jobs and working for, you know, half the wage. And not only that, but a lot of the Americans who lose their jobs first are told to train these people for the job, and then they get sacked. And then you see the Americans working at a McDonald's.
Oh, absolutely, Dave. It's been a while. I actually wrote about that, but it's been at least a few years. Occasionally I write an article on immigration, and that's exactly right. They bring in these people they want. They issue these visas, and they really want them used for the kind of people that they want to bring in as opposed to the people they don't want to bring in. But they even want to bring in those other types, too, the unskilled ones. Because of the meatpacking plants and the hog plants and the plants that have jobs that Americans don't want because they're so dangerous and the pay isn't all that great. So it's wonderful to bring in somebody from another country who is delighted to have any work at any pay and get them in legally, illegally, whatever. I hate the word illegal, undocumented, whatever, and they'll bring them in. And everybody knows this is going on, and then every now and then you get these ICE Gestapo stormtroopers come in and raid a company or raid a community and just sweep people up en masse, including U.S. citizens. It's like you go fishing with these big nets and you're looking for salmon or something, and you scoop up everything that gets into the net.
The purpose of those raids is not to stop the immigration. It's to intimidate the immigrants who work. So that they will be a passive workforce. And I'll tell you, I went back in the 70s. This is nothing new. I lived in Los Angeles, and we had a alternative newspaper, a bunch of reporters had put together called the LA Vanguard. And we had a cartoonist who was named, an excellent cartoonist. His name was Miguel Tejada Flores. And he was, not only was he American, but, you know, his family went way back in Los Angeles. and as is true of many of the Spanish surnamed Latinos living in the Los Angeles and San Diego areas, they're not descended from Mexican immigrants. They're people who've been in place since, you know, the Spanish conquest. But at any rate, he routinely was being picked up in East L.A. or elsewhere by the what was then called the immigration, you know, the migra, and deported as a teenager. He'd be deported to Tijuana, and then he'd have to call his father to pick him up. And, you know, he would tell the guys, I'm an American. And they'd just basically say, yeah, yeah, prove it. And they'd haul him off down to Tijuana and dump him. And then he'd have to get home. And you know, I just saw this because I knew him, but, you know, he obviously was not unique. And I know it's going on now also with not just Mexican, you know, people being deported to Mexico, but also to other countries where it's even harder to get back after they make the mistake.
It's shocking that this kind of persecution goes on against selected groups, people because of their ethnicity or their religion. We've had a long-standing war against Muslims in this country. It's kept me busy, Dave. I've written on maybe as many as six dozen over since I began writing, and I personally know three Muslim men unjustly sitting in a federal prison. They didn't commit any crime, but they were charged with a crime, and they were railroaded, and the prosecution intimidated the jury to convict them. Literally, that's the way the scheme just repeats itself over and over again. And I have another article that is all written. I'll either get it out tomorrow or Monday. It's the latest two Muslims that I spotted. And to what degree they have any culpability whatever on what they were charged with, but the script literally seemed like it was a rehash of an older article I wrote about 6 months ago, and I mentioned that in the individual involved in the article that I have finished now, two people accused of wanting to attack a military recruitment center. And how do they want to do it? I mean, they didn't just want to go in with a handgun or something. You hear what the plot is, and you never really know what all is going on. You get mainly the side of the government, the prosecutors, and what they say in their press releases, in their indictments, what the major media pick up and repeat, and occasionally you can pick up some little tidbits from a major media article if they have the legitimacy to go into a community and talk to others who know the people involved. And when they do that, they pick up comments where people say, well, I'm absolutely astonished. I mean, I know this guy, and I simply can't believe he would ever do anything like that. He's very normal. He gets up in the morning. He goes to work. He comes home again. You know, he's no different than any of the other people in this neighborhood. And you piece these pieces together, and it just kind of comes out with an overall picture that, well, here's another person or two or three being scammed. These people, supposedly the latest ones in my article, and this was information that broke a couple of days ago, these people wanted to attack this recruitment center with automatic weapons, with rocket launchers that launch grenades, grenade rocket launchers, whatever the official name is, with hand grenades that I guess you throw, and anything else they could get their hands on. And supposedly the guy who was not really the mastermind, but by the information put out, the guy who may have thought of the idea in the first place, then got another guy to go along with him. He had something like $800 to $1,000 or $1,200, and he expected that to be able to buy all this hardware. Well, I think one AK-47 would set him back a number of hundreds of dollars. I have no idea what a grenade rocket launcher would cost They certainly don't sell them on the open market. I don't know, anybody could expect to get their hands on one, but I've written other articles, Dave, where people were accused of using, literally accused of using missiles to shoot down an airplane. That's number one. And then a different kind of missile, Stinger missiles, to shoot down an airplane. Other high explosives and bombs, and the plot is always the same.
Almost every time when you get into this, you'll find that at the bottom of it is a government informant who's coming up not only with the idea, but with the money and with the goods.
That's exactly what happened.
You mean that's the whole deal. I mean, the model of this was the guys in I guess it was Miami these Haitian guys who supposedly were going to try to blow up the Sears Tower where you are.
Oh yeah.
And you know, there was a case where you had a bunch of guys with no money, no jobs, no prospects, and this government informant comes along and starts offering them money and saying, you know, you'll give them uniforms, training, you know, all this stuff. And what these guys were doing, they were completely harmless guys. They had no, they weren't even Muslim, for God's sakes. They were Haitian. And what they saw was a schmuck who was going to give them money. And if they went along with, you know, his wacky ideas, he was shelling money out to them. And they didn't have the sense to realize, well, wait, why would he be doing this? You know, but for them, they thought they were taking him, because he was a wacko who wanted to hire them, and so he was giving them money. That's what it was about. They weren't ever seriously going to blow up the Sears Tower. They were trying to take this guy for his money.
Oh, that's exactly right. These were guys that had committed some petty crimes. I wrote about them, it took the government three times, three separate trials to convict them. They either had a hung jury or were exonerated on most of the charges, maybe hung on a couple of other charges in two trials, and it took the government reworking the case three times to get these guys convicted. They were also charged with wanting to blow up an FBI building in Miami and maybe something else as well. You know, an Oklahoma City type event. And these guys,
right.
I mean, these guys were duped. And the ones I just wrote about, same scheme. You nailed it. An FBI informant who, and the other piece of that was a convicted felon. Aha. Well, you can see the scheme, and it's happened before. They get some guy either charged to be convicted or already convicted, and by playing along for a bigger fish, they reduce the sentence or they let them off, and they pay them very well for doing this. And the same scheme repeats over and over again. So when you see the script, it's like a Hollywood screenplay. And that's what I said in this article. And I absolutely have to believe that unless somebody can give me cold, hard facts, I can believe that two more guys are being scammed for something they never dreamed of, and they're going to go to prison. If convicted on all charges, these guys will go to prison for the rest of their lives.
That's it, yeah. It's something, you know, it's not just entrapment, because, I mean, these guys weren't even interested in these things. They were completely sucked in, and I think if you look carefully, you'll find out that most of the time, they didn't take it seriously either, and were not. It wasn't that they wanted to do it; it was that they were getting money.
Oh, absolutely, Dave. And you wrap all this up in one package, and you see a country run by people from both parties who simply can't fight another war they don't want to fight, who are strip mining jobs and wealth from the great majority of people in this country, shifting it up to the top. Mostly the top 1%, the top 10% do well enough at least, so they're not in dire straits. The other 90% in great trouble, getting in worse trouble. We are putting innocent people in prisons. We have the largest prison population by far in the world. Per capita, it is off the charts, absolutely off the charts. Russia is the closest to us. On a per capita basis, we are four times what China is on a per capita basis. And we have the audacity to call ourselves, I use the word our loosely, for the people who run this country to call it a democracy. We commit all these horrendous crimes around the world and at home, plus destroying the environment. And we could go on and on and name one issue after another to prove how ill-governed we are. Dave, I'm with Thomas Jefferson, who said in the Declaration of Independence, and I quote that in this new article that I did, and he believed, and I, if it was good enough for him, it's good enough for me, that when a government governs destructively, it's not just the right, but it's the obligation of the people in the country to throw it out and get a new government. And he didn't say, well, you know, go storm the barricades and shoot the bastards. But he said, get rid of that government. And I think he said that with a little latitude for people to use whatever means to get rid of oppression and get something that at least resembles democracy, even if in fact it isn't, but get rid of this horror that is governing us now. We absolutely are being governed that way now. And according to the Declaration of Independence, that's not the law of the land, but if we could loosely look at it that way, then we have an obligation to free ourselves of this monster that's destroying us.
Yeah, no, I think that, you know, when you look back at history, of America during the colonial days, that actually the repressive apparatus that we live under today is more extreme than anything the British were imposing on the colonists.
Oh, no question. No question.
If the right was there to overthrow the oppressor at that point, then it certainly exists today.
Boy, does it ever. And even back in those days, we effectively got rid of the old order and put in the new order, and it was something not too dissimilar from what happened in Greece, in Egypt in the past few months. They got rid of one despot and they inherited another one. They inherited the existing military regime governing just as despotically. There's no democracy in there. There's none. So, you know, we got rid of the British crown and we put in America's version of an aristocracy that, at least in the original version, we had Jefferson and Madison and Washington, and later on we had Lincoln. And what do we have today? Republicans and Democrats and Barack Obama. My God.
Yeah. The only thing we managed to get rid of was hereditary leaders. But you know, the in terms of hereditary power, because of the way the tax policy works, with inheritance taxes being done away with, and with confiscatory taxes for the middle class, but virtually no taxes for the wealthy and corporations, we've created a hereditary ruling class. Wealth gets passed down quite handily.
Oh, well, that's exactly it. We don't have a king or a queen, but we have an American aristocracy, and it's the super wealthy in the country, individuals with great inherited wealth, and the giant corporations, and they rig the system so well that companies can make billions of dollars in profit and game the tax system, not only to avoid paying taxes, but a good number of them actually get rebates. But it even embarrassed Warren Buffett at one point, and he's no hero of mine, I'll say that. But it even embarrassed him enough to say that he pays taxes in a lower bracket than his secretary.
Yeah, I read that. But, you know, the other thing that's an interesting thing, we have such a mythology in the United States that people can't – partly it exists because people in America don't travel and don't live in other parts of the world enough to realize how badly we're being lied to. But, you know, it's not just that our living standards are lower than they are in Europe and even in some parts of Asia, which would astonish a lot of Americans who say we're number one, you know, mindlessly, but that also – there's this myth about that in America there's no classes and the people can become anything they want. But the reality is that in Europe, in particular, the supposed old Europe of, aristocrats and, classes and stuff, including England, the studies are now showing that it's easier to rise out of your class as a working class person in Germany, in France, and in Britain than it is in the United States, and that's statistically proven.
That's exactly right. We're nearly out of time, Dave. I would say the one country left that really has the greatest opportunity for workers, and how long it'll last, I don't know, but it's Germany. And Germany survived the economic debacle best. It has its industrial base. It's an export giant. A prosperous country in the midst of a lot of economic despair, and people can actually go to work and earn a very nice income and very nice benefits working in the big industrial plants, the same plants that have disappeared from America and continue to disappear. Maybe they'll all be gone one day.
Plus, everybody's insured, and when you lose your job, you get really good benefits for as long as you need them until you get another job. All those things that we're told would wreck an economy, they have.
They have it, and they're prosperous. Dave, the clock has run out on us. I will let you continue on your journey. My great thanks for coming on. I look forward to getting you back again.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks, Dave. And
always
join us again tomorrow, same time, of course, three times a week, weekends at 1 p.m. Eastern, Thursdays at 11 a.m. Eastern. Do join us. Make us a regular habit.